I can still remember being really shocked. I was standing at a cashier's counter at Lowe's a number of years ago. In fact, I was looking at some old study notes and came across this story of our twins were five, and we put up a swing set in the backyard, and we had an extended beam that allowed us to hang one of those swings, wooden swings that you get a couple of adults on, you know, the kind you, where I'd take my wife out there and swing, and then I'd tell her she can't complain and never take her out. You know what those swings are like? You with me? Didn't work. But at any rate, I decided, well, I can't afford to buy one, so I'd get a kit and put one together, which is rather dangerous for me to try to do. But I went and got it from Lowe's and had it in the cart, in the box, and I pulled up to the cashier and was paying for it. And she said, when she saw the box, she said, I just got one of those a week ago. And I said, really? How's it holding up? And I realized that's the wrong thing to say. How's it holding up under the strain, as it were? She just laughed. And she said, oh, it's holding up just fine. And she said, but I got to tell you something. And she kind of leaned over the counter and whispered. She said, there are only 10 bolts in the box. I said, really? I didn't know what that meant. And so she said, well, the directions call for 12. And I said, oh, thank you so much. Don't you hate getting something from the store you've got to put together and you're one bolt short and it holds everything together? I said, look, hold the box for me and I'll go buy two bolts. I'll pick two up, 18 cents. And she said, no, you only need 10. Now I was confused. I said, okay, so thank you. You're trying to help me from being confused. When I put it together, it calls for 12. I only need 10. There are 10 in the box. And she said, no. What you do is you go home, you put it together, and then you come back and you tell the manager you only had 10. The directions called for 12, and you can get two free bolts. Wow. I can put my kids through college now on that 18 cents. I said, that's wonderful. Thank you, ma'am, for that. Can I have my receipt? And I was just about to leave, and she said, now, you know that this swing has to be stained for it to last. And I said, yes, ma'am, I could tell by looking at the picture on the box. I'm good with pictures, and could tell that needed stain. And she said, well, it'll only take about a quart, and we only sell that stain here by the gallon. I said, really? She said, well, here's what you do. By now, I'm looking around for cameras that are going to hone in on me. And she said, you get a gallon, $10, take it home, take the lid off real carefully, and then you paint your swing. It'll only take a quart. Won't even be able to tell it. And you put the lid back on it, really careful-like, and you bring it back, and you can be refunded. I'm thinking, why did I pick this lady's lane? What is she trying to do to me? I don't know you. I don't care. Give me my receipt. I walked out to my pickup truck, and really, as I read this, I could still see myself at that counter thinking, what in heaven's name is going on? And I walked out to my pickup truck, and I found myself muttering something that my dad had sort of built into us four sons, that the price would change depending on the illustration. But I found myself saying, my character is worth more than 18 cents and a gallon of stain. You know what I mean? I couldn't believe it. And I thought, you know what that lady had just done? She had effectively told me that her character was worth less than a gallon of stain and 18 cents. You know, I wonder, how much is yours worth tonight? In fact, are you being tempted to sell it? And if you are, what are you getting in return? Are you getting a sales contract? Are you getting a promotion or maybe the praise of a boss? You've taken credit for something that didn't belong to you. Are you getting some supplies you can use at the house? Are you getting a better grade on a research paper? Frankly, there is an epidemic of dishonesty that is sweeping the planet. It is impacting the church, and it will affect more people than Ebola or any other virus that you can imagine. And it is equally dangerous. Sadly, Christians are as likely as non-Christians to allow this besetting sin, this ever-ready temptation, this practice that will harden your heart like nothing else, to wrap itself around our ankles and trip us up. It might be falsifying income tax returns. It might be committing plagiarism. It might be bribing someone to get a permit. It might be ignoring construction specifications. It might be copying a computer program or a movie or a music DVD. One author put it this way: unless we battle dishonesty, we will return to deceit like a duck to water. What's written on the price tag of our character? How much is it worth? Well, as we explore this particular issue, I want to explore it in a positive sense. And we'll just do it in a word, one word. The word is integrity. Let's explore it that way. What I want to do is just define it, cross-reference it, principalize it two or three times, and then I want us to watch it demonstrated in the life of a believer. And I want to tell you right up front, defining integrity is a lot easier than demonstrating integrity. Somebody once said that every day you get out of bed, you will face a test of integrity in some form or another. I found it interesting, by the way, in my study to learn that the top 10 searches online for the definition of some word, the top 10 words, English words, where people searched for their definition, the top 10 included the word integrity. Millions of people literally were looking this word up to try to figure out what it meant. If you go to the dictionary, you discover the word means simply to be honest, free from corruption. Webster defined it as moral uprightness, which you can no longer define anything with the word moral in it. In the Old Testament, the word finds its root in the Hebrew word thumb, which signifies completeness or wholeness. In other words, there's nothing hidden, there's nothing missing. It's interesting that the high priest in the Old Testament was to wear this breastplate, and as a part of that breastplate, it included thummim. That's the plural form of thumb, thummim, which literally meant perfections or integrities. When he appeared in formal ministry service, he wore the Urim and Thummim. Urim means lights. Thummim, integrities or perfections. They were part of his breastplate that covered his heart. Many Old Testament scholars believe the Urim and Thummim were precious gems, or maybe even some stones that he would tuck into a pocket hidden inside that breastplate. The Lord commanded Aaron, and he said, when you appear before me, you are to wear these over your heart. Exodus 28, verse 30. No high priest could approach God without his heart, as it were, symbolically covered by integrity. I think we have a wonderful New Testament analogy, by the way, since we are all priests, since we all can approach God, since we all can represent God to our world, we stand in His presence. We should stand in the presence of our world with our hearts covered with integrity. And we're told, in fact, are we not, to battle in an armor, and that armor, those pieces of armor, include a breastplate of righteousness. Rightness. Analogous to wholeness or integrity. Now, if you cross-reference this word, this Hebrew root word, you discover, first of all, it is a defining characteristic of Holy Scripture. David wrote, "The law of the Lord is perfect." Psalm 19, verse 7, there's that word. The law of the Lord is whole. The law of the Lord is without corruption. When God speaks, in other words, He always tells the truth. It's impossible for God to lie. Secondly, integrity is part of a godly testimony. Job would insist, even though he is suffering dearly, in Job 27, verse 5, "Until I die, I will not put away my integrity from me." Same root word. David would write in Psalm 101, verse 12, that "I will walk with integrity of heart within my house," which informs us that integrity isn't perfection, at least from a human's perspective. It is being confessed up, as they would say. He says, "I'm going to walk that way in my house. That's how I want to walk," which is another way of saying we ought to walk with integrity among those that know us best, those who are closest to us. We will keep our word, which means that you will keep your vows to your wife or your husband. It means you'll keep your word to your children. If you say you'll show up, you'll show up, and if you forget or you can't, you will ask forgiveness. It means when they hear you in the house talking to somebody on the phone, they know that what you're saying is the truth. They don't hear you calling in sick, knowing, watching, having seen you load your golf clubs in the trunk of the car. When you shake somebody's hand on a deal before you ever sign the contract, that handshake matters as much as your signature. Those who know you best know you mean it. When you sign on for some ministry assignment, you're going to be the teammate that finishes the job and carries the weight. You do right. You're honest. I had pulled this from a magazine and put it in my files. A man named Cecil Brenton was a Christian mechanic. Aren't you glad to know a Christian mechanic? We got a few of them in this church, and what a blessing that is. If you fix things for a living, whether it's a computer or a car, God bless you for being honest. I'd love to shake your hand. In fact, I'll give you a hug. This is the South. I can do that legally. I think. I'm so grateful for you. Well, here's a man. His name was Cecil Brenton, and he was a Christian mechanic. And by the way, he wasn't a Christian mechanic because he had fish symbols on his garage door or on his business card. He just kept his word. And in 1972, this article reported from the Toronto Star, a reporter visited 13 auto garages with a car in perfect condition except for a purposefully loosened spark plug wire. The thing you wish they told you you had, and that was all, right? That's all they did. He didn't let anybody in on it because he wanted to do a story on the integrity of the auto mechanic industry. So he would sample 12 mechanic shops and made no mention of who he was. Out of all the mechanics he visited, all of them squeezed cash out of him in one way or another, claiming, you know, this problem, that problem. Some were severe, very costly, others a little more minor, but all of them costly. All of the mechanics did that except one, Cecil Brenton. He told the reporter that it was nothing more than a loose spark plug wire, which took less than a minute to fix, and there was no charge. Well, of course, while this reporter is compiling all this evidence, obviously Cecil stands among or apart from these others, and the reporter pressed him for a reason behind his honesty, and he simply responded, "I am a Christian. I'm a Christian." Well, after the story ran in the paper, drivers flocked to this man's garage. He never liked business. In fact, he would work 12 more years before retiring. 10 years after retiring, Cecil Brenton died, and the Toronto Star reported his passing with a separate and full article about his honesty and his business practices. That story never did go away. And the headline of the article read this: Cecil Brenton, 89, Christian mechanic known for integrity. And nobody who read that article had to look up the meaning of the word. They didn't do a Google search. They knew what it meant. It ought to be a part of our godly testimony. Let me make one more cross-reference. Not only is integrity a defining characteristic of the Bible and a part of a godly testimony, thirdly, integrity is a quality of true leadership. Asaph writes a history of Israel that runs all the way through Psalm 78, and by the time he gets to verse 72, he talks about David, and he says this: he shepherded Israel according to the integrity of his heart. Your translation might read, with an upright heart. It's the same word, same root word for integrities or integrity. Frankly, there's a vacuum, isn't there, in leadership in our world. Our own political administrations over the last several decades brought before ethics committees. We've watched one after another. We've read one article after another. In fact, in 1 4-year congressional evaluation of ethics, one report revealed that among these sitting senators and representatives, 19 of them were caught writing bad checks, 3 of them were arrested for assault, 8 were caught shoplifting, 14 were arrested on drug-related charges, 29 of them were charged with spousal abuse, and 84 of them were arrested driving drunk. In the highest reaches of political power, integrity has been rushed into the intensive care unit. We're not sure it's going to survive. We praise God for those who know Christ, who take that testimony into the political world. I saw a sign of one who's part of our church is running for a seat. The average citizen lives, don't we, with a sense of suspicion regarding those in power of being dishonest. In fact, the chaplain of the Kansas Senate made it into the news some time ago when he prayed as the Senate was to open, and he prayed this prayer: All-knowing Father, is the reason he called him that. All-knowing Father, help us to know who is telling the truth today. One side tells us one thing and the other just the opposite. If neither side is telling the truth, we'd like to know that too. And if each side is telling half the truth, give us the wisdom to put the right halves together. Amen. Now, the Apostle Paul uses the same idea. It's the New Testament word blamelessness for those who will lead in the church, those elders, honesty for those deacons, according to 1 Timothy chapter 3. Honesty is a prominent characteristic for leadership in the church. They should be men of integrity. In fact, if their handshake doesn't matter, If it can't be counted on, the confidences of those who follow them are then undercut and the church is hurt. A man, by the way, a man or a woman of integrity doesn't necessarily put on a show. They are the same in the dark as they are in the light. Now let me show you a demonstration of integrity from someone who would have been applauded for violating it. And that's why I want to take you to this particular narrative. Everybody would be cheering him on for violating his oath. Go to Joshua, the book of Joshua. While you're unsticking the pages there, let me set the scene for you. Joshua is leading the Israelites into the promised land. But just because the land is promised doesn't mean that it's going to be handed to them. In fact, it's filled with idolatrous, God-hating, child-sacrificing, demonized kingdoms. With the help of God, the people of Israel are going to effectively become the judging hand of God in wiping these nations out. They will be brought to judgment. The Lord miraculously parts the waters of the Jordan. The people of Israel march across on dry land. They encounter Jericho. You remember that story where God miraculously blows over the walls and the Israelites shout in faith. The news spreads, of course. Terrified kings form quick coalitions to battle Israel, and they draw up in battle array. Now, according to the plan of God, there are seven Canaanite nations living in the land who are to be put to death. It'll be capital punishment, judgment from God. Now, Deuteronomy chapter 20 informs us that they are unrepentant idolaters confirmed in their rebellion against God. There are people groups and nations beyond their land that they could form peaceful covenants with, but these in the land have dug in their heels and they're going to fight God tooth and nail. With that in mind, notice how one nearby city comes up with a rather ingenious plan. Go over to chapter 9 and look at verse 3. But when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and to Ai, they on their part acted with cunning and wind and made ready provisions and took worn out sacks from their donkeys and wineskins worn out, torn, mended, with worn out, patched sandals on their feet and worn out clothes. Reminded me of college days, by the way. Verse 6. And they went to Joshua in the camp of Gilgal and said to him and to the men of Israel, "We have come from a distant country, so now make a covenant with us." But the men of Israel said to the Hivites, "Perhaps you live among us, then how can we make a covenant with you?" And they said to Joshua, "We are your servants." And Joshua said to them, "Well, who are you and where do you come from?" And they said to him, "From a very distant country, your servants have come." Again, they're stressing this because they could be allowed to live. We've come from a far off country. But because of the name of the Lord your God, you know, we heard a report of him and all that he did in Egypt. In fact, look down at verse 11. "So our elders and the inhabitants of our country said to us, 'Take provisions in your hand for the journey and go to meet them and say to them, we are your servants. Come now, make a covenant with us. Here is our bread. It was still warm when we took it from our houses as food for the journey on the day we set out to come to you. But now, look, it's dry and crumbly. These wineskins were new when we filled them, and behold, they've burst. These garments and sandals of ours are worn out from the very long journey.' So the leaders took some of their provisions, that is, they inspected them, but did not ask counsel from the Lord. And Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them to let them live. And the leaders of the congregation swore an oath to let them live." Now notice the discovery is made in verse 16. At the end of 3 days after they'd made a covenant with him, they heard that they were their neighbors and that they lived among them. That is, they live nearby. In fact, what they're going to discover is the city they're living in is located 6 miles away from Jerusalem. In other words, Joshua and the people are duped. Joshua's the leader among the leaders, and he feels it more severely than the others. But they discover that these particular Hivites living in the city of Gibeon don't live 6 weeks away or 6 days away. They live less than 6 hours away from what would become the capital city. Can you imagine? I imagine before the ink dried on this peace treaty, the Gibeonites went around the corner and they double over in laughter. Can you believe we pulled this off? This is Oscar-winning performances if you've ever seen them. Those Israelites are so naive, and that Joshua, is he green or what? This is great. Now the real question is, what's he going to do? What's Joshua going to do now that he has discovered that he has been fooled? What's going to happen to his promise? Well, I can tell you without looking what most would say, well, hey, that's just a piece of paper. Not according to Joshua and the leaders. Look at verse 18. But the people of Israel did not attack them because the leaders of the congregation had sworn to them by the Lord, the God of Israel. Don't miss this little commentary at the end of verse 18. Then all the congregation, that is the entire Israelite nation, murmured against their leaders. Here's Joshua. He's in a lose-lose situation. I mean, the entire nation is willing to mount up and wipe these people out. And in so doing, restore, you would think, at least this is how it sounds, and it sounds good, the credibility of their leaders. We'll just eliminate this problem. And Joshua says, no. No? Are you kidding? We can't destroy these people? Now think about it. Joshua is stuck in the middle. He's literally now defending the people who've made a fool out of him. Skip over to verse 26. So he, Joshua, did this to them and delivered them out of the hand of the people of Israel, and they did not kill them. In other words, Joshua had done something wrong. He hadn't asked the Lord's advice before signing this peace treaty. He'd only looked at the stuff in their hands. He hadn't asked the Lord for wisdom to see the stuff in their hearts. Now he faces an incredible test of integrity. Is he going to break his sacred oath to people who obviously don't deserve it? Is he going to do something else wrong? Do two wrongs make a right? Is it ever right to do wrong in order to make something right? No. It isn't. In fact, no matter that the people around him are urging him to swing a sword and tear up the treaty, they refuse. Joshua and these men, even though keeping their word made their lives miserable. You ever thought about the fact that the temptation to lie or to be dishonest or to break a vow or to violate a promise is to make our lives better, to make something easier, to smooth something out, to eliminate pressure, to move from unpopularity to popularity? We rarely want to suffer for being honest, right? Maybe you've lost a job that way. It made your life miserable by doing what was right. Maybe you lost that client because you wouldn't lie and say, look, we can't get that product to you for 3 weeks. You want it in one, so we'll tell you you can get it in one, even though we know we can't. You lost the client. Maybe you lost a friend. Maybe you lost a passing grade. Maybe you lost a boyfriend. A relationship. Because you were honest. One author wrote about his daughter and son-in-law and their three children who went for months without adequate housing in Vienna, Austria. Austria, that part of the city, had scarce housing. The real problem, though, was landlords who had available housing were demanding that they sign the lease, falsely claiming to pay less for the rent than they actually had to pay. That way the owners could claim less revenue and pay less taxes. They couldn't find an honest landlord. See, Joshua here, don't miss it, he is the victim of his unwillingness to break his promise. So the pressure mounts. He suffers a major drop in the polls. He's defending his enemies rather than eliminating his enemies. All because of integrity. So what does he do? Well, you'll notice he gives them their request. They'd asked twice to be the servants of Israel. So he says, all right, I'll let you do that. You can live. Look at verse 27. Joshua made them that day cutters of wood and drawers of water for the congregation. And notice this. And for the altar of the Lord to this day in the place that he should choose. Most Old Testament scholars I read see in this Joshua's commitment to the gospel of God's grace. Joshua's assignment of these Gibeonites, these idolatrous Gibeonites, keeps their idolatry from retaking hold. Because their work is going to be carried on in connection with the tabernacle. It's more than that, though. Their work, and this is Joshua's plan, their work is going to expose them directly to real, genuine, legitimate worship of the true and living God. That's like somebody, you know, stealing. They get caught, they've robbed your house. I mentioned several months ago, we had been broken into, and they finally did catch those guys. They had targeted pastors, and they went online, they did some searches. I really want to replace our big church picture online with a little shack, you know, because they assumed that we'd have a lot. So they robbed from 9 pastors, and I told you all about that. They did catch him. I got a letter this past week that they have been sent to jail. Well, you know, if I had a choice and an opportunity to repay them, what would I do? Well, a few thoughts come to mind. Unsanctified thoughts. But what if I said, you're... punishment is going to be to clean the facilities of our church every day and usher during the services. That's kind of what he does. He says, your penalty is I'm going to bring you in and you're going to be around priests and worshipers. And you're going to haul this wood and this water in and you're going to see people worshiping God. And he knows that's going to influence them dramatically. He's going to expose them to the glory and the grace of God. Even in his difficulty, he cared most about his testimony. If you track through the Old Testament, by the way, you discover the Gibeonites will later refuse to follow rebellious Israelites who go back into idolatry. You discover that when the nation is divided, David places the tabernacle in Gibeon for safekeeping. You discover 500 years before the birth of Christ, during the leadership of Zerubbabel, the genealogies record that among those who longed to return from exile to Jerusalem were these Gibeonites. One of the more fascinating things I discovered in Israel's history is the public commitment of the Gibeonites in the record of Nehemiah's own journal. When Nehemiah returned to rebuild the city of Jerusalem, who would volunteer to help him but these Gibeonites? They helped him complete the reconstruction of their former home. Their forefathers had been deceivers, but their deception had been overwhelmed by a man of integrity, and a lineage of faithful service to God had begun. Have you ever thought about the fact that you're about to go out there and enter a world and be surrounded by Gibeonites, idolatrous pagans, who don't know what it means to worship a true and living God? Do they know who you are? When you do business with them, how will you do business? They're going to deceive you at the drop of a hat. But can they trust your word? Can they trust your commitment to integrity, your promises, your work ethic, your honesty? Every believer faces a test of integrity every day. We don't know what it's going to look like tomorrow. We want to ask God to help us get ready. I close with this. I got a letter from a man recently who'd just been released from prison. I got it a couple of weeks ago. While incarcerated in the Texas prison system, he had begun listening to our program and for some time was corresponding with Wisdom's office. His name is Brian. And he wrote this, and I quote, "After 21 years, 8 months, and one day, I was released from the Texas prison. My, how the world has changed. Why does everyone constantly stare at their mobile phone? There is definitely an adjustment phase, but I'm prepared for that because now of my solid foundation in Jesus Christ. I want to thank you for all the free material you sent over the years, which gave me a solid biblical ground to stand upon. It wasn't long after I was released that I was tempted to compromise my integrity. A few days ago, I took my written computer driving exam, and I passed barely. The customer service rep scheduled me for a driving test 1 week away, and then excused me to leave. And I said, wait, what about a permit that allows me to practice driving? She said, well, that'll cost you $11. But listen, it's only a week away. Why don't you just save yourself the money and practice without anybody being the wiser? I think she used to work at Lowe's. He writes, I responded, no way, no way. I'm going to practice doing the right things for the right reasons, even if it costs me a little more. I'm not doing that again. And then he thanked us. That's another way of him saying, listen, my character is worth more than 11 bucks. Way to go. This test that we face will never take a holiday. It will not take a semester off. It's going to be waiting for you and me tomorrow. Each of our studies in the evenings, I have wanted to take us to the Lord with the words from one of the prayers from the Valley of Vision. And let me read this to you. Let this be our prayer as we prepare to face another week where we battle, in this instance, dishonesty, which will certainly harden our hearts and keep us from being receptive to the Spirit of God. The prayer reads, Almighty God, as I cross the threshold of another day, I commit myself to thy care. Incline my heart to thy ways. Mold me wholly into the image of Jesus as a potter forms clay. Make my lips a well-tuned harp to sing thy praise. Let those around me, let me add all those Gibeonites, see me living by thy spirit, unconfirmed or unconformed to lying vanities. Clad me in the entire armor of God, showing holiness in all my doings. May I view all things in the mirror of eternity. Order this day all my communication according to thy wisdom and to the gain of mutual good. May I speak each word as if my last word and walk each step as if my final step and if my life should end this day. Let this day be my best day. And all the people said, Amen. God bless you, friends.